Sofiane.
Je vais vous faire une rapide introduction de qui est James Gurney. Et ensuite, nous aurons la chance non seulement de l'entendre, mais de le voir commenter ses œuvres pour cette rencontre. Donc, James Gurney est né en 1958 en Californie. Il est l'auteur et l'illustrateur d'Inotopia. Et dès l'enfance, c'est quelqu'un qui a eu une imagination débordante. Il était passionné par les civilisations anciennes. Et il décroche une licence d'anthropologie à l'université de Berkeley et un diplôme d'illustration au Art Center College of Design à Pasadena. Donc le jeune Gurney, fraîchement diplômé, part sur les routes américaines, fait son trip. Il prend clandestinement des trains, traverse l'Amérique et fait beaucoup de dessins, travaille beaucoup ses sketchbooks. Et c'est d'une certaine manière ce qui va le former dans le dessin tout d'abord. On va le retrouver dans les années 80, vers 83, où il va dessiner les décors pour un film d'animation de Frazetta, qui est le Tigrin, la glace et le feu. Et à partir de ces années-là, il va principalement illustrer des couvertures de fiction, science-fiction et autres, et parallèlement travailler avec le National Geographic en dessinant des images consacrées aux civilisations perdues, à des héros, etc. Alors c'est peut-être cette alchimie entre le voyage à travers les États-Unis, cette passion pour les civilisations perdues, cette passion pour les héros oubliés, qui vont faire que James Gurney va se concentrer sur son propre univers, construire son propre univers, et donc depuis 88 peindre à l'huile son propre univers qui sera par la suite d'Inotopia et toutes ses suites. Et cette fresque personnelle qui rappelle techniquement, mais il va nous parler tout à l'heure de ça, un art pictural qui est plutôt issu de la fin du 19e siècle, va retracer des mondes oubliés, les mondes perdus, où les dinosaures seraient encore là et cohabiteraient en toute amitié avec les hommes. Alors juste quelques chiffres pour vous donner l'étendue de sa célébrité. Depuis 1992, d'Inotopia, c'est 4 ouvrages qui ont inspiré peut-être une vingtaine de romans pour la jeunesse, qui a été décliné en jeux vidéo, qui a une série télévisée, un dessin animé. Il a été traduit en 18 langues et a été vendu à plus de 2 millions d'exemplaires. L'œuvre de James Gurney a été exposée une vingtaine de fois internationalement. Donc c'est quelqu'un qui a l'habitude maintenant d'être sur la scène. J'espère que vous prendrez beaucoup de plaisir avec lui à l'entendre commenter ses œuvres. C'est quelque chose d'assez rare. Voilà.
Thank you, Frederick. For those of you who don't know, Frederick works as a conservator at one of the premier museums of science fiction, Maison d'Ailleurs, in Yverdon, Switzerland. The director of the museum, Patrick Giger, helped to organize this exposition of Dinotopia artwork, first at his museum and then to travel it around Europe. So I'm very honored to have it here today at Utopial, and to thank the directors for allowing it to be here, and thank you all for coming. Instead of doing a lot of talking, I would like to show you some pictures to illustrate the methods that I use to make realistic pictures from the imagination. So I call this talk Dinotopia, Reality and Imagination. And I'll show you all of the methods that I use, the maquettes, using people for models, doing sketches, using photographs, to do the Dinotopia artwork. Also, I'll show you what went into the making of the poster artwork that you've seen for the festival. For those of you who are not familiar, the name Dinotopia is short for Dinosaur Utopia. But I like the Chinese translation of the title, which comes out as Terrible Lizard Happy Dream Kingdom. Kind of a different way of expressing this idea of an island where humans and dinosaurs live together. The first book tells the story of a father and a son who are shipwrecked on the island in the 1860s, so a little over 140 years ago. The second book, The World Beneath, continues their adventures as they discover evidence of a lost civilization. That lost civilization is developed in a prequel story called First Flight, which came out in 1999. And that's more of a dystopian world where machines are taking over the island in a city that eventually is lost in Dinotopia's history. The artwork in the exposition is mainly from the newest book, Journey to Shandara, or Voyage à Shandara. And that one continues the adventures of Arthur Dennison as he explores the eastern part of the island. Each book is a complete work. It's a standalone sequel. So one doesn't need to read all of the books to understand each one. There was also a TV adaptation of Dinotopia in 2002, produced by Hallmark Entertainment. I was not very involved in this project because I don't even own a TV, actually. This is set in the modern world, so it's a whole separate part of the universe of Dinotopia that doesn't overlap much with the illustrated books. But let me tell you a little bit about how I got started with this. As a child, I loved reading adventure stories of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and Robert Louis Stevenson, the books that were illustrated by the American illustrators N.C. Wyeth and Howard Pyle. I also liked to read early copies of National Geographic magazine to learn about archaeology and exploration, especially the exploration from 100 years ago when archaeologists were still finding places like Machu Picchu. So I thought if I could go out in my front yard and dig with my toy trucks, I could find perhaps an Egyptian pharaoh or maybe a dinosaur. I wanted to learn artwork, but I also studied archaeology, as Frederick mentioned. I learned to draw mainly from books. This book called Drawing Made Easy was one that just taught me how to draw simple shapes and make them into realistic things. And then, although I went to art school for a short time, most of what I learned was from old art instruction books from 50 years ago or 100 years ago, including the one called The Academy and French Painting in the 19th Century, which explores the way art used to be taught in the academies. One of the things that artists would do, and that I've done as I've learned, is to do copies from artists that I admire. So some of the American illustrators, including Norman Rockwell here, these are studies that I did in order to learn from their work. These are landscape paintings by an American landscape painter, by Thomas Moran. So these are small copies in oil. But I want to just take you into this world of the French Academy. This is an imaginative painting of Gulliver and Lilliput by Gérard Georges Vibert in 1870. And it would look to us like a fantasy illustration, but that's what artists all through the history of art have done, illustrations and paintings from mythology and from the Bible and from Greek and Roman history. So in the academies, they were drawing from the model. This is the teacher, William Bouguereau, who is a great academic painter. And the goal of all of this training was the Prix de Rome. And part of that was to go into a closed room with no references, and you were given an assignment out of the blue, and you had to come up with a design for a picture. So in 1876, it was Priam pleading for the body of his son Hector from Achilles. This was the drawing that was done by Jules Bastien Lepage. Pascal Daniel Bouveret, who lived fairly near Brittany, was also a contestant. And this shows the work of two different contestants. Then they went and to their studios with the benefit of models and references and did the final paintings. This whole process is exactly what fantasy artists today try to do. And even if we look at the artwork, in this case of Pascal Daniel Bouveret, he was painting people in Brittany, and he was using photographs of models posing outdoors. As far back as 140 years before our time. Here you can see him sitting in his studio with drawings of the figures on transparent paper so that he could arrange his composition. This tradition of historical painting continued with Howard Pyle and other artists like Dean Cornwell, the Golden Age American illustrators who influenced my approach to picture making. So this is what my studio looks like in New York State, about 100 miles from New York City. I have a drawing table where I do my drawings. I have a camera on a tripod, a theater light, and a stand for holding models of dinosaurs. This is where I mix the paint on a plastic surface with a place for the brushes, a color wheel, and a place for the paints. But one tool that I love to use in the studio is what I call a gallery flambant or a flambeau. What it is, it's a device for destroying bad paintings. And every artist knows that you have a painting that doesn't work out, that's a disaster. So what do you do with all these bad paintings? What I've done is developed a piece of technology just outside my house, and I can take a painting outside there and set it up, and it uses the power of the sun, concentrated 350 times, to turn a painting into a cloud of smoke and a pile of ashes. And it feels very good to get rid of all the bad paintings this way. I did this little video as a YouTube video to talk about my new book, which is called Imaginative Realism. But let me take you now into the research that goes into doing paintings of dinosaurs, not just for a fantasy like Dinotopia, but for a science magazine. Often, all you have to do when you're doing an extinct animal, in this case, this is a mammal, this is a giant rodent, like a big rat, the biggest rodent that ever lived, and it lived in South America. But all that paleontologists have found is the skull. So my job is to talk to scientists to try to get their ideas for how these creatures would have looked and how they would have moved. This is Jack Horner, a paleontologist who lives in Montana in western United States, showing me the skeletons of some young dinosaurs. Horner's ideas about dinosaurs are revolutionary. One idea about the Tyrannosaurus rex is that it may not have been an active predator. It may have been a scavenger. And that shows a different side to the giant monstrous creature of the Tyrannosaur, a vulnerability that's very interesting. This painting I did to show how a Tyrannosaurus might drink water. Did they lap up the water with their tongue? Or did they close their mouth on the water and gulp it the way some birds do? No one knows these behavioral things. Horner just came out with a book called How to Build a Dinosaur, which is an interesting science fiction premise. It's even better than Jurassic Park. The idea is to take the DNA from a chicken and to change the genetic switches so that you can create teeth and arms with claws and even a tail. So perhaps one day we will discover that every bird has a dinosaur inside it. And my pet parakeet loves this idea because he knows that now he is not just a small bird, but really, in his heart, he's a dinosaur. Here's another recent discovery from China. This is a small fossil of a sleeping dinosaur, very much like a sleeping bird. So I talked to bird experts about how birds sleep, and very often they sleep on one foot. So I did this painting for a science magazine showing this kind of dinosaur covered with feathers. It's a flightless dinosaur, but sleeping as a bird does on one foot. I also worked for National Geographic magazine doing archaeological paintings. This is a scene set in Egypt about 700 BC. And this is another project where I started with a line drawing and then did the final painting of a tomb in Tarquinia in Italy. This is from the Etruscan culture. And working on these paintings of ancient cities made me think about fantasy cities. So I did this painting just as a single painting, no idea yet for a story or a book. This is called Dinosaur Parade, and it shows people and plant-eating dinosaurs walking through the streets of a Roman-style city. After doing several paintings like this, I thought it might be interesting to connect them with a map. So I drew a small map. This is a very quick map, and I didn't know what to call this island yet. And in this point, I called it Panmundia, as if it encompassed many different parts of the world. Every time I do a new Dinotopia project, I do a new map, and I put a lot of places on the map that I haven't explored yet in the books to give opportunities for future stories. I also developed the character of a scientist artist who explores this island. This is Arthur Dennison. And he's modeled after the Renaissance man type explorer that we would have seen back in the 1860s. I also made some sketchbooks to try to imagine what Arthur Dennison's sketchbook would look like. We had an exhibit of artwork in the Smithsonian Museum, and they said you could put a model like this in the glass case to make it look like Arthur Dennison's actual sketchbook. To research that kind of book, we went to the Library of Congress, where they have a huge collection of 123 million objects. When you go there, they don't pay you any money to speak. Instead, they say, we'll look up for you anything that you're interested in. So I asked them to please show me examples of sketchbooks by artist explorers who traveled the world before the era of photography. So when Napoleon went to Egypt, he brought with him a lot of artists to document the adventures. So this is an example of some of the small watercolor sketchbooks that explorers brought with them. And this was an inspiration for the Dinotopia book and its style. So for every painting, there's always a lot of different kinds of small sketches. I call them thumbnail sketches or croquis. Sometimes they're used to plan the light and dark pattern in the pictures. Sometimes there are very loose sketches like this, trying many different ideas for composition. Here's an example of one sketch to try to plan a picture where there's a dark figure against a light window and then a white bearded figure sitting in the shadow. And you can see how I took that and then did the line drawing on the board, and then the final oil painting is done directly over the line drawing. Here's another sketch that shows the plan for a light and dark pattern of a picture, and then you can see how that helped to guide the final painting. Each picture has a lot of different kinds of sketches, including some that work out the colors, some sketches to learn about the fossils of the dinosaurs, and those were the sketches that I used for this painting called Song in the Garden that you can see in the exposition. I also do storyboard sketches. These are to plan the sequence of the story in the same way that an animated film is planned. So this is one that is drawn on a piece of pre-printed cardboard. And then for a book of 160 pages, like Dinotopia, there are about 80 different individual storyboard panels. Throughout the process of developing the story, these storyboard panels keep changing all the way through the process. I begin with an outline and then a storyboard and then the final artwork, and the very last thing is the final writing, which comes after the artwork. The reason for that is, as an artist and a writer, a lot of ideas come from the process of designing and drawing the characters. Here's another storyboard for The World Beneath book, done in colored marker to plan the color sequences. Another thing that I like to do is to build three-dimensional maquettes. So, for example, when I was doing a painting of this dinosaur, I did a small maquette out of a special kind of clay that hardens in the oven. And you can see when that's painted with acrylic and then photographed outdoors, it provides the shadows that I need in order to understand how this form would look in actual light. Here's another example of a painting that I did recently for a science magazine showing a recently discovered giant snake called Titanoboa, about 40 feet long, so about the length of this entire room. First, I did some quick sketches, and then I made a small maquette and photographed that maquette and used the information from those photographs for this oil painting. And without having looked at the three-dimensional form, it would have been very difficult to imagine, for example, the cast shadow from the hand on the neck of the snake, or the shadow that comes from the tail of the crocodile. Those are things that the maquette often provides. So my studio is filled with a lot of toys and models and maquettes, some that I made myself and others that were made by other people. This is a maquette of Bix, who is a character in the Dinotopia books, and this was made by the Jim Henson Creature Shop. They sent this to me with these realistic glass eyes, and when my cat saw this maquette, she was terrified and ran to the other end of the house. Not only for dinosaurs, but also for developing designs for alien creatures and science fiction and fantasy creatures, I often make small maquettes, very quick maquettes, like this one. I made one out of clay and then did a charcoal drawing. Then for the hand, I made an armature and then a maquette, I'll go back one, so that I could see how that hand would actually hold a paintbrush. For vehicles, I also like to build models. This one is a design for a walking vehicle used in Dinotopia. And it's made out of plastic model robots, Japanese robots that are used to get ideas for mechanical forms. Here's another one of a flying machine, somewhat similar to the one on the poster, but this one's based on a dragonfly. And you can see here how those wings can be posed at any position, and you can look at it from any angle to get ideas for the vehicle. Most of the maquettes are very quick, like this one here of the landscape around the windmill is just made from a special kind of cardboard, and it's spray-painted gray. And that maquette provided the information for the final painting here in oil. Sometimes I can set up an entire scene. So starting with this pencil drawing, I then set up a scene of dinosaurs that were scale models with each other and then made an arch to see how the light would look in that particular scene. And that information helped to guide me in how to light this grouping of dinosaurs and people. This picture this picture shows you a maquette for Waterfall City, and this maquette is probably more finished than I usually do, but I knew that I would be looking at this corner of the city often, so I wanted to plan that out carefully. I also have a rough maquette of Waterfall City that I can turn in various angles in order to see how it would look under different lighting conditions. And to do something that's as complex a city as Waterfall City, it really helps to have a maquette like that. This might be a little hard to see, but this is just to show you how roughly this is built. This is made of styrofoam and cardboard and paint and glue. The whole maquette only maybe took about 2 or 3 days to make. Then from the photos of that maquette, I get ideas for the lighting, and then I do a perspective drawing. In the case of this city of Chandara, this drawing took about 4 or 5 days to plan all the different vanishing points. And here you can see how the final painting is based very closely on that drawing. Now, models are the people who pose for the people in the characters in the Dinotopia story. The character of Lee Crabb is a person who doesn't believe in this utopia, and he's kind of an unhappy character. And every utopian story needs a character like Lee Crabb. But he's based on a friend of mine who posed for the character. Another model of mine is a friend who's an art teacher who posed for the character of Oriana in the second Dinotopia book. When you have a large scene with a lot of different figures, sometimes I set up first a maquette to plan this dinosaur running through an Olympic-style sporting event, but then I'll invite over my friends and neighbors in the small town where I live, and they all wear costumes, and then they act out as a group the scene. So it's sort of almost like directing scenes from a movie, trying to get everybody together for something like this. Often, though, I'll just take the pose myself in a mirror and then do a charcoal study to take the pose. And the good thing about working in this way is it helps me to identify with the character and to feel what the character is feeling, in this case, the balance and which leg is carrying the weight. That was the basis then for this picture of a pirate, which appeared on one of the Dinotopia novels written by other authors. Here's another charcoal study done in the traditional way, where I was wearing a wig and standing in front of a mirror. And then I used that as the basis for this picture. But very often I use photography for reference, especially for a moving pose like this one where I'm running, or if I need someone else to pose, like my wife who posed here. And often when I'm wearing a funny costume like this, it's the time when the FedEx truck comes up our driveway. It's hard to explain that to them. I often also work with engineers and experts to help guide my reconstruction of the engineering or the architecture of Dinotopia. This man designs fire trucks for a living, so he's an engineer and an artist. And he asked me, how would Dinotopians fight a fire? Well, I was ready for that question, and I showed him this sketch, which shows the pompier on top of the ladder, and it shows the pumping mechanism on the lower right. But he said it would never work And I asked him why not, and he said, "Well, the guy on top of the ladder is in a very dangerous place. He could easily fall, and the weight of the hose is too much, and there's no protection for the dinosaur on the front of its neck. No, there's also no way to carry the people to the fire." And he said that from an engineering point of view, the pump mechanism is too complicated. So I said, "Well, how would you design this?" So he sent me a drawing that he did that shows a design that would actually work. He even figured out the hydraulic pressure that would be needed to pump the water all the way up the neck. And as you can see, the dinosaur is operating the pump with its foot. It's a very clever design. So then my job was to take his design and make it into the final painting. And to thank him for his help, I asked him to pose for the fireman, the fire chief in Dinotopia. I also used a lot of costumes for the various people in the picture. Here are a couple. They come from Renaissance fairs and from community theater productions. And another thing that really helps is working outdoors and sketching from life. So I want to show you just a few sketches. This was a gentleman who was across the aisle from me on an airplane flight from London to Cleveland earlier this summer. So sometimes I just try to draw exactly what I see. Other times I try to capture things that are moving, like this chicken was running around in a farm, not holding still, so I just did quick sketches. When drawing animals, you can never get them to pose too long. I tried to draw this sheep and these chickens. I wanted to draw the whole figure, but they went to the other side of the farm. So that night, I went to a restaurant, and I opened up my sketchbook to this page, and I looked over, and there was a guy and his wife who sat down in the same pose as the sheep and the chickens. So I drew them in. It was not a good idea, because the guy got up, and he walked over and looked at me to see how his portrait was coming out. He had had a few too many beers to drink, I think, because he looked at the drawing for a long time. He didn't say a word. He went back to his seat, he sat down, and he pushed his beer away and never took another drink that night. Sometimes when I'm sketching on location, I like to change what I see and try to imagine a science fiction idea. So in this case, I'm drawing a picture of the chassis of a truck with just the engine and the wheels. But I wanted to imagine the idea that there might be a chassis of some kind of flying vehicle from the future. So I tried to project my imagination into the future while I was sketching that actual chassis. So this is the vehicle I was imagining, a flying car with wings. And then this was the little sketch that I did on location. I did the same thing on the way to this festival. When I was in the airport in New York coming here, I looked at the airplane that was parked there and then tried to imagine how it would look if it was the same vehicle that would fly from Nantes to Dinotopia. And then when there were some people standing around waiting for the airplane, I tried to imagine how they might look as strange creatures from another world. Just a couple of days ago here in Nantes, we went over to look at the Museum of Jules Verne. So I did a sketch while I was sitting there looking at it, trying to imagine this museum on the rock breaking away from gravity and then flying off to another place, perhaps wherever Jules Verne is now. I want to show you the steps involved now to finish up in designing the poster for the Utopiale Festival. I wanted to do something that involved Jules Verne, since this is his original place, and also to have something from the city, especially the old city of his time. So I found these photos on the internet and tried to imagine some ideas. One idea was to have some giant creature, maybe a cat, sleeping somewhere in Nantes. And then I did a couple of other sketches showing insect-like vehicles taking off from the Place Royale. And these were a couple of sketches. The one in the middle was the one that the directors liked the most, but they said, "Can you please make the insect look a little bit more appealing?" So I tried to think what kind of insects are the most appealing, and I think butterflies are perhaps the most, so I went with that idea. So this little video will show you some of the steps involved. After doing some sketches, I built a maquette out of a material called Sculpey. And then I drew the shape of the wings on a heavyweight paper and then painted them with acrylic. I did this on two layers and then painted in the details of the blue parts of the wing. Then I applied some adhesive between the layers and glued them together, and then cut them out of paper so that I could have wings that were colored on both sides and that they could be bent in any position. Then I painted the maquette. There you see it. And after taking photographs of that maquette under different kind of lighting conditions, and after looking at a lot of photographs of the Place Royale, I did a line drawing on illustration board. So here you can see what it looked like before the paint was applied. I wanted to give special attention to the fountain, and it was very exciting just a couple of days ago to actually see that fountain. This is my bird, who's a parakeet, who often sits on my hand while I'm working. And then the next step was to seal the surface of the board. Those of you who are artists, this is an acrylic layer that protects the surface of the board from the paint. So here's the view in the studio as I was working on the final painting. The very first step then is the pencil drawing, and then thin washes of oil that looks something like watercolor, but it's actually an oil. I did the sky, the buildings, the distant scene, the fountain, and then the figures, and then finishing up the fuselage of the vehicle. But the wings needed a little more color, so here is a glaze of orange color on the wing to try to give it a little more impact. Another thing that I wanted to make sure I included were some gentlemen here in the period. This was set in 1893, and also perhaps a portrait of Jules Verne as if he was maybe visiting in Nantes. So here is the process of painting in Jules Verne. In this case, I didn't have a very careful pencil drawing first because I changed the angle of his head. So I just started with a brush painting in his beard and then painting in the skin tones. I looked through a lot of old photographs to see what kind of costumes people would have worn at the time, what kind of neckties, and also the kinds of top hats that he might have worn. Often at this point in a picture, you wonder, how will it ever come together? But after working on it for a while, here's how he looked. The whole process took about, for the painting, took about 2 weeks. So here's the final picture as it appeared. And to conclude, I think what all of us do as fantasy or science fiction artists and writers is to try to look at familiar things in a different way, or to combine things that don't go together. So if you start with this picture of a stormtrooper from the Star Wars universe, he seems like a bad guy, very dangerous, very angry, very unhappy. But if you turn him upside down, all of a sudden he looks happy, he looks friendly. In fact, you can take him and put a little neckerchief around him, and he looks like a little bit like the character called the Pillsbury Doughboy that we have in America. And all of a sudden, something that looked terrifying is not so terrifying at all. And to see more about the process of doing the Dinotopia pictures, I encourage you to visit the blog that I do. It's a daily blog called Gurney Journey, .blogspot. So thank you very much. Désolé que je ne parle pas le français, but perhaps...
C'est moi qui vous remercie, James Gurney, pour cette présentation que je ne connaissais pas. Et du coup, vous aurez pu répondre à toutes mes questions sans que je les pose. Donc, l'un des intérêts, en fin de compte, des Utopiales, non seulement est de pouvoir visiter les expositions d'un artiste, mais là, quand on a ce type de présentation aussi, peut-être de s'acclimater avec sa façon de travailler, son inspiration, etc. Et peut-être, si vous le désirez, il nous reste encore une bonne dizaine de minutes et j'aimerais vous donner la possibilité peut-être d'intervenir directement avec James Gurney. Donc il y a un micro à disposition. Si vous avez des questions de tout type, ça peut être technique, ça peut être pas vraiment personnel, mais si vous avez des questions pour James Gurney, allez-y, il va se faire un plaisir de vous répondre. Donc faites simplement un signe de main et puis une personne va venir vous apporter le micro pour poser la question. Il faut se lancer, n'ayez pas peur. Hein. Personne.
No.
Bien. La vidéo était parlante.
I want to Well, I would like to say one thing about my wife, Jeanette, who maybe some of you have met. She and I are both artists, and we met in art school. And what I do would not be possible without her help, and in many different ways, both as someone who looks at artwork and gives me ideas and criticism, but also who puts up with me making a mess in the house. And it's very, I'm very lucky to be able to be married to another creative person.
Bon, moi j'aurais comme... Oui, il y a une question là-bas au fond. Si on peut lui donner un micro, monsieur.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Comment, j'aimerais savoir, là vous avez montré comment vous travaillez, mais comment vous avez imaginé que les gens vivent et les dinosaures vivent à Dinotopia?
Well, I try to begin by imagining the creatures, the dinosaurs, and how they would behave and move. First by looking at the form of the dinosaurs and to think of how they would actually look and appear, but then also how they would communicate. I liked learning about how whales and elephants communicate through sounds, and I thought that could be one way. But I also invented an alphabet so that dinosaurs could leave footprint messages for humans and have their own system of writing. One of the keys to this whole concept was to go beyond the idea of dinosaurs as domesticated animals, but instead to think perhaps that dinosaurs domesticated the humans on this island, or at least that the civilization had a give and take back and forth. Because after all, dinosaurs were successful on the Earth for over 100 million years. So they must have been doing something right. So I was trying to think of ways that we've learned from the animal world, from birds and from primates and dolphins, and then to try to imagine, and of course this is a bit of a romance on my part, to imagine dinosaurs as these kind of creatures that would really be worthwhile partners in a civilization. Good question.
Une autre question? Non. Moi, j'en aurais une, en fait, quand même. Par rapport au festival et à la thématique qui a été approchée ici tout au long de ce week-end, c'était sur les mondes meilleurs et les mondes possibles ou les mondes pires. Et il y a peut-être un constat actuel, c'est que la science-fiction ou la fantasy, la plupart du temps, illustre actuellement plutôt des mondes qui sont pires. Avec Dinotopia, vous l'avez approché, il y a quelque chose de l'ordre de l'utopie, il y a quelque chose de l'ordre du bien, et à quelque part c'est un rêve que vous réinvestissez, quelque chose de l'enfance. Et j'aimerais savoir d'où ça vous vient, en fait, cette envie, en fin de compte, d'illustrer un monde meilleur.
Well, I think in science fiction and fantasy that utopias and dystopias are very closely related, and they influence each other a lot. And for me too, with Dinotopia, I've developed ideas, especially with the earlier world of Dinotopia, where technology gets out of control and where people lose their connection to nature. And that is a part of Dinotopia that's dystopian. But in developing a world of Dinotopia, I'm really not as concerned with expressing philosophies or religion or politics or economics. Those are the most difficult things to do in a utopia. And if I could think of a way to approach them that was entertaining and interesting, I would probably develop that more. But the thing with those three areas, religion and economics and politics, is that utopias can suddenly become dark. And instead, what I really was interested in doing was to explore the daily life aspects. How do you clean up after a dinosaur? And how do you generate energy? And how do you travel? And how do you communicate? And those aspects of ordinary life were really more interesting to me than trying to look at this as a world that should necessarily teach us a lesson.
D'une certaine manière, est-ce que vous revendiquiez une certaine inscription dans une continuité d'une littérature, là vous l'avez présenté très bien dans votre PowerPoint, d'une littérature qui date du 19e, c'est une littérature utopique que même Jules Verne a approchée par exemple dans les 500 millions de la Béguin. une certaine continuité, les naufragés, l'île perdue, les dinosaures, une technologie ou autre. Est-ce que vous vous sentez proche, genre fils de?
Well, I certainly took a lot of inspiration from James Hilton's Lost Horizons and from Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, but also going back even farther to the tradition of Atlantis and to Plato's ideas of a lost civilization. And it's such an ancient idea, and that idea has been expressed in literature and art in so many different ways. So that was really a beginning point for me, was to look at the tradition. And perhaps this is an extension of that, I don't know, but I certainly have been inspired in that way.
Très bien. Je ne sais pas si le public s'est un peu réveillé, il y aurait des questions. Bien. Madame.
Bonjour Monsieur Gurney,
bonjour.
Voilà, je voulais savoir si vous aviez déjà été sollicité par le monde du cinéma, soit pour l'adaptation de votre série, soit dans un autre contexte.
Yes, when I first did the paintings for Dinotopia, I had worked in the movie industry back in the very early, the late 80s and the early 90s. And I would talk to special effects people about what are the most difficult things to do. This is before digital effects. The most difficult things to create are people riding on large animals and large water effects like a waterfall. Those things were impossible before because you can't miniaturize those effects. So that's what the reason I did Waterfall City and Dinosaur Parade was to do pictures that could never be made into film. And then the Dinotopia book came out a year before Jurassic Park. And Jurassic Park showed that it was possible to use computers to bring dinosaurs to life. But still, that was only a few minutes of the film. In order to do Dinotopia, you would need digital effects for the entire film, not only for dinosaurs, but also for the cities. So the project was optioned by Columbia Pictures and was in development for many years from about 1993 to 97. But eventually, the rights came back. And they went to Hallmark Entertainment to do the television series. So as a story, Dinotopia is a difficult one to do in film, I think, because it's such a different art form and such a different idea. Film really requires a three-act structure and a lot of conflict, but Dinotopia is not based on that idea. When I was developing the fantasy world of Dinotopia, I looked at the Lord of the Rings world, and the world of Narnia, and the world of Star Wars, all of which are brilliant works, but they're all based on the idea of good versus evil and the temptation of the dark side. And I didn't want to do that kind of story again. So I took a lot of inspiration from Gulliver's Travels, Jonathan Swift, and some of the stories that are more about whimsical exploration and episodic stories. The Irish folk tales and the Italian folk tales have this quality also. But unfortunately, I think that approach to storytelling, it works fine in a picture book, but I think it's very difficult to make that work in a film without introducing the cliché elements of the bad guy and the armies having a giant battle at the end. But good question, thank you.
Bien, une autre question encore.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
Vous avez dit tout à l'heure que vous faisiez d'abord les illustrations et qu'à partir de ça, vous écriviez l'histoire, mais... Enfin, souvent, c'est un peu le contraire. Donc, comment ça se passe? Comment vous arrivez à faire que tout ça ait un lien, en fait?
Yes. Well, you're right about that. I think in some cases, books are developed where a story is written first and then illustrated, especially if a writer and artist are working together. But for me, I really needed to develop the two together. Sometimes a picture would inspire a character or a conversation. Other times I would write something that would inspire a picture. But the thing about the writing is it's really the very last thing, the thing that's easiest to change. So the writing really fit into the final paintings. Doing the artwork was a lot like watching a silent movie almost. I could imagine all of these scenes happening and have a general idea of the story, so I knew what was happening. But I didn't really know for sure until the very last thing when I wrote the final dialogue. So I know the general outline early on, but it's just the final details that come last.
Bien, alors ce sera la dernière question parce qu'on est un petit peu en retard. J'aimerais remercier James Gurney pour sa présence et sa générosité et vous rappeler que à partir de 3h, donc dès maintenant, il sera la librairie en dédicace. Ses livres, ils sont présents et il veut bien, en plus de signer pour les gens qui auraient eu des questions ou qui aimeraient lui parler plus personnellement, converser avec vous directement. Donc profitez-en, une belle salve d'applaudissements et merci à vous.
Merci à tous.